Meet Natural Cycles, the only FDA-cleared and CE-marked birth control app that's built around your body. The Natural Cycles app pinpoints your fertile days by tracking shifts in your temperature, so you can plan or prevent pregnancy naturally. It's easy to use. Simply take your temperature in the morning with our free Bluetooth thermometer included with our annual plan, or sync with your Oura Ring or Apple Watch. The app analyzes your data and tells you daily whether it's a fertile or non-fertile day. Natural Cycles is 93% effective with typical use and 98% effective with perfect use. But beyond effective birth control, the app helps you understand your body and cycle better than ever. And unlike some period tracking apps, Natural Cycles provides an advanced data protection program to keep your information private and secure. Ready to go hormone-free? Sign up for the Natural Cycles annual plan and get a free Bluetooth thermometer, plus 15% off your subscription with the code RADIO15 at naturalcycles.com.
You felt ya. Welcome to Village Oak Tree for July 31st, 2024. I'm your host, Terrence O'Donnell, and I appreciate you joining me once again. Today, I want to welcome my friend, Sam. She's from Canada, who's always been an outspoken activist on many levels. We chatted back and forth online for the last couple of years, and now I actually get to introduce you here and let you see the writer in person. She's going to talk about all the things that she writes about. So, first, we'll do a little bit of Canadian politics. I say a little bit, and then we'll talk about what she's famous for. So let me bring Sam up here.
Hey. Hi, Terry. Nice to see you.
Yeah. Happy to be here. Well, how are things in Canada?
It's a nice, very, very heavily rainy day. So we'll see if my internet holds up. So far, it's been doing okay, knock on wood.
Right.
Other than that, I mean, it's going. I think things are going.
Yeah.
Things are happening. Not all of them great, but I mean, yeah.
That's a given. I mean, mm-hmm. As far as the rain goes, you're in the Atlantic Maritimes. It's kind of expected.
Yeah, I was shocked actually. We saw the sun for a few days this week.
Oh, there
I was
go.
Astonished. I don't see it very often. I don't know if you can tell by the lack of any tint to my skin at all. kind of glow in the dark over here, but yeah, we got some sun.
Take all you can get.
Yeah.
I know I didn't live in the Maritimes, but I live so close to the Canadian border I could throw a rock across and hit one of the Canadian guard posts over there. So we used to have that same problem when I lived up there where we'd get a lot of wet weather and it would dry out a little bit after the solstice in June, and it would run a little bit. It might get a little bit, you know, once the blue moon, we might see a 90 degree day or so here in July or August, but then that was it. By the end of August, first part of September, that was, you know, and by mid-September you got the furnace running.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. No, we've been having 30 degree heat waves for the past little while, which is, I think, over 100 for the way you guys reckon temperature. It's really not.
Yeah. Normal. I never did figure out why the United States, well, I do know why, but I just, the ignorant why they wouldn't adopt the metric system like everybody else in the world. Yeah.
And we grew up kind of going back and forth on it. Like, because we've always used the metric system, but at the same time, a lot of our books come from the States. So, like, we kind of grew up going, we'll talk about feet, and then we'll talk about meters, and we'll go back and forth, and just automatically.
Right.
Just, so, like, don't ask me to give you the full separation between the two. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
It's such a mix.
Well, in my case, I travel all over the world, and that's why I say everybody else uses metrics. Why is the United States holding out? Well, I kind of know why, you know, because the apple hasn't fallen too far off the British tree. That's one of the biggest reasons. But then the British, you know, come on. We can't even mirror the British. Now, the Americans, they just, I guess they figure they have to do it, you know, they have to do their own thing. They always got to be their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even when they're sticking in somebody's eyeball. So tell us a little bit about you. okay, as far as your activism is concerned.
Okay. Always fun when you get to talk about yourself. That's the hardest part of these little meetups. So I actually don't have much of a background in politics, which I guess surprises a few people. My background is actually in the arts. I went to an arts and trade college, and I studied foundation visual arts, and then I moved into metal arts and jewelry. But part of what we learn, surprisingly, is actually we take at least one semester set aside for political activism, as part of the job of an artist is to be involved in political activism. And there's always those people who say, like, art shouldn't be political, and those people don't know anything about the industry at all.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's very much the basis of what we do. So I had always had very strong opinions. I was that annoying little kid who used to like organize other kids on the playground to pick up trash and stuff like that. I was the pain in the butt for all the adults all the time. So it was kind of a natural progression as I grew up to become more opinionated and to become more open about those opinions. And so then I discovered Medium, which is where you and I met. Mm-hmm. And I started originally with fiction, following the art side of things, and then very occasionally doing a little political post, and then having a strong opinion about something and doing another political post, and then another political post, and then very swiftly the fiction disappeared from my writing completely. And so over the past year or so, I've really built up into just a background of writing about politics, about human rights, about climate change, about current events. Mm-hmm. And that's transitioned into World Weary, which is my website where I run the newsletter and the podcast now. So
yeah, it's all good stuff because I've been following you for a couple of years now, and you did write one really good fictional story, and I read it from my other podcast here 3 or 4 months ago. It was pretty good, actually.
Oh, thank you.
I was hoping you would do some more.
I've got a few in the backlog. I do have a fiction section on Medium, but those are quite old stories. So at some point, maybe I'll go back and rewrite those, bring them back up to code.
Yeah. I mean, it's all good because if you ever throw another one like that one I did read for you about the guy, you know, the sea monster and the diver, you know, I'll be all over it.
I do like that one.
I mean, that podcast has a very worldwide audience. And it's got, I was looking at something here a couple, 3 weeks ago, and I post it everywhere. So not only does it go out on Spotify, which goes all over the world, but Substack is also sending it all over the world. So it's got several thousand people that look at that now. It's like, well, okay. So apparently reading stories is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people learn through reading fiction, I think, a lot of the time. Like, we kind of discount it as, like, think of it not as fiction writing as kind of lower brow or just for entertainment. But I mean, no, we put in what we know into what we write. So it's a way to make lessons for people and for them to absorb that in a way that makes more sense than just giving someone a stated command or, you know,
right.
You can't force someone to learn what you say, but if you put it in a story, they can kind of empathize with a little bit more, I think.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, fiction is kind of like an offset from the real life. We don't like to talk about real life that much. It gets to be, you know, like everything that's going on right now. And so let's talk a little bit about the differences between the Americans and the Canadians. Okay. Only because I'm as familiar with you guys as you are with us. Okay. Only because I lived up there for half of my life. Crossing, you know, for me, crossing the border as a kid was nothing. And then 9/11 came along, and all of a sudden it was a big thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I got in so much trouble, you know, the 10 years that I lived up there after I got out of the Army. And I didn't have any trouble with the Canadian customs and border people. It was the Americans. They're the ones who gave me the worst grief.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this latest thing here where I see the Americans just recently here last few days backed off on, you know, I subscribe and I watch CBC News from Canada, have for years. My late mother did for, you know, pretty much ever since we were little kids. You know, when I was a kid growing up, we didn't have much in the way of media, if you want. Living so far north, we didn't have much in the way of newspaper. And my folks couldn't afford a subscription to the local newspaper. So we didn't really get the news unless it was word of mouth, which you know how that can go. So we had two TV channels. We had Channel 6, which was CBC Canada, and we had Channel 8, which was the one and only American channel that we were allowed to watch. And it had all of the American news feeds. And basically, they told us what they were going to allow us to watch on the American channels. So you might get something from CBS. You might get something else from ABC, something else from NBC. It all depends on whoever the programmers were back in those days. And of course, in the wintertime with the wind blowing, if you wanted to get one channel or the other, you might have to rotate your channel a little bit. And be honest with you, more times than not, we got better coverage we got better news coverage from the Canadian side. And we also, a lot of times, got better reception from CBC Canada than we did the Americans. So as a kid growing up, I watched more Canadian television than probably anything else. But it kind of, you know, in my family, that's where we got our taste for what we called the real news, because even back in the 60s and 70s, American news was biased. And again, you know, you had to worry about, well, what are they really telling us? We aren't telling us anything. Then we turn into CBC and we listen to BBC UK or BBC Canada. And we're like, oh, okay. So that's what they were talking about. Well, that's what's really going on. Okay. And so, like I said, it became a habit for, you know, my family and all my friends up there. You really want to know what the real news was? Tune into the Canadian channel, because the Americans definitely are not going to tell you anything what the real deal is.
I've heard that from other. I've got a lot of friends in the States because I travel in and out of the States quite often, mm-hmm. several times a year. I've got friends as far down as Kentucky who tell me the same thing, where she's basically like, I don't get news from American channels because they don't tell you anything. They give you the approved statement. We listen to Canadian news, or we find the BBC, or we look at what's going on in the world, and that's where you get the headlines, because they talk about America too. They talk about what's going on within the States. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, you know, even with that here lately, a lot of them have been a little jaded. So CBC Canada had their issue here last year, their corporate issues, and Ottawa had to step in a little bit. And all of a sudden, so I get it. You look at the news, no matter where it comes from, and you kind of weed out the trough, as I call it, the wheat chaff. BBC UK is notorious right now for swinging with the UK government, and I've been really jaded about watching their stuff. The Guardian used to be my go-to, and now they have started swinging over there, and I'm like, okay.
Oh yeah, the anti-trans sentiment is picking up a lot coming out of the British news.
And plus a whole lot of other things. So again, you know, I'm like, all right. So now I've gone to a more focused. I mean, if I want to know what's going on in the Middle East, I listen to Al Jazeera. If I want to know what's going on in Eurasia, I listen to TRT, Turkish Radio. If I want to know what's going on in Western Europe, I tune into the EU news. So, yeah, I mean, we've got to learn to diversify, because unfortunately, all the media these days, everywhere you go, you know, all over the world, they're biased in one fashion or another. And you kind of have to, you know, I'll listen to maybe three different versions of the same story before I finally figure it out. And okay, so this is what they're really trying to say.
Yeah. I did the stereotypical thing and I sprung for Ground News not that long ago.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not paid to promote them at all, but it's a very handy service because it does give you the, you know, this is right leaning, this is left leaning, this is neutral mm-hmm. reporting. So it gives you that kind of like at a glance, so I can avoid being stuck on one side.
I did the same thing too. When I started reading a bunch of stuff from Mother Jones here lately.
Yeah.
A lot of their political articles are pretty spot on and they're not biased too much. They don't write that much, but usually they're not afraid to, worry about where their hat's hanging. So that's a good thing. But stuff like that can be a little hard to find. far as that goes.
Very difficult. Yeah, it's very difficult. There's a lot of propaganda disguised as news these days.
Oh,
anybody can go online and post whatever they like. So
yeah, it goes back to the CBC. So I mean, like I said, I read, you know, the CBC and weed out most of it. But last few months, you guys have been all over the place with Paul Vierre and Trudeau and all kinds of stuff going on. So tell me, what's the truth?
Well, that kind of depends on where you're standing. The truth is, I'm not a huge fan of, well, I mean, it's obvious I'm not a fan of the Tories. First of all, I'm not much of a conservative. I do not like Poilievre. For several reasons. First of all, he's a cryptocurrency bro, which is entertaining. He wants to defund the CBC, of course.
I read about that.
Mm-hmm. He's very much opposed to the radical gender ideology in public schools, and he's basically just echoing all the anti-woke sentiment from America, right? And even worse, the Tories, just a couple of years ago, I don't remember which year specifically, I'd have to look it up, but they actually brought over the leader of, I don't know if you're familiar with the Alternative for Deutschland out of Germany, their far-right party. They brought their leader over to meet with prominent conservative politicians here in Canada. And they got caught with pictures of her online, and that got posted everywhere. I did a Medium article about it where I basically was just like, so Tories, how's it going? What's up with that? And of course they tried to pull the whole, well, we didn't know what they stand for. Of course not. That was a complete mistake. And Poilievre was like, I had no idea that was it. It was like, yeah, of course
yeah,
you didn't.
Sure. Right.
Of course.
Yeah.
On the flip side, I mean, the Liberals are the Liberals. We tend to refer to them as the pipeline party here, where I live. They were in control for quite a while. They are definitely better than the Conservatives, but that's not saying a whole lot. I mean, if you want a political party that actually cares about the people, that's actually pushing for change, the Greens are really it, you know? The NDP is good, but they have a problem where they don't really campaign for certain areas of the country. So they kind of, there's no chance of them to, our electoral system is a little bit different. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yours mirrors the UK in a lot of ways and, you know, EU in general. And that's not a bad thing. And a lot of times I wish the Americans would do that. But, you know, of course, as messed up as the American system is right now, I don't see a lot of hope for it, truthfully. I mean, this business with Kamala Harris, everybody's waiting here on bated breath. It's like, okay, is she going to do something or is it going to be 4 years more of the same? Everybody's waiting and we're waiting. I mean, there's just in 2 days, she started to kind of reach out a little bit. She actually made a trip to Wisconsin today. Oh, boy, you know. So there's positives. Now we're all just kind of waiting to see, well, how far is this going to go? Because we know how the politics are down here. She's going to be afraid to rock the boat simply because she doesn't want to lose what she's already gained. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of balancing act she's going to perform here in, up until November. And then see what happens after November. That's going to be the real crusher.
Yeah, I'm more optimistic now with Kamala Harris stepping to the forefront than I was with Biden.
Because
like Biden did accomplish. He did accomplish some things. He was a strong candidate until
October.
Started to go down to basically. He was definitely more right leaning than Kamala is, interestingly enough. She does lean more to the left on many issues, which I think is very hopeful. She's still very much an establishment Democrat. But right now, that might, it's from the progressive standpoint, it's a problem because we'd love to see a more progressive candidate step forward and run. But right now, kind of keeping to the generic Democrat run is probably the safer bet for the Democratic Party right now, because the right has whipped up the message of anti-communism, anti-woke, and all that thing so far right now.
Last thing she wants to do is come out like a Bernie Sanders.
Which I always love when Americans call him a radical leftist.
I know.
mean, it's like he is the he would be middle of the road moderate Canadian, right? Like,
right. I know. It's a shame, but yeah, there's a lot of people right now who would vote for him in a heartbeat. But you know, he says I'm too old, and you know, that's given what's going on right now. I'm upside. Yep, I'm all about you working from the sidelines. You know, he says a lot of good things, and we'll kind of let it go at that. So just out of curiosity, then again, this goes back to the news from north of the border here for the last year or so. All this business out there in Alberta, Saskatchewan, where the American politics has bled over the international border and melted itself into politics out there. I mean, things haven't really gotten any better out there in the Western provinces.
No, and that's unfortunately very common. Canadian politics always follows American politics by a few years, like always in lockstep. We are right behind you. It has to do with our Overton window, which if any of my readers are listening, go ahead and take a shot because I said the thing. But our Overton window is inextricably linked with the American Overton window. So whatever is acceptable to discuss in American politics becomes accessible to discuss here. And that's been going on forever. Like all the way back in World War II, after the Japanese internment camps were built in the States, we built them too. The site of one of them is not that far away from where I live right now. That's been going on the whole time. As soon as Trump started with the anti-immigrant rhetoric, there was mass deportation in Alberta, I think it was. Things like that, right? Like this is just, it happens. After 9/11, we had suspected terrorists that were arrested, detained without charges. Things like that. Like we always follow. Now we've got the anti-woke rhetoric. Now we have laws and restrictions being passed against LGBTQ plus youth. We've got, in New Brunswick, there's another push there as well, which we already call them New Brunswick, North Florida. So that's not surprising. Yeah. The premier of New Brunswick is up for re-election. Please get rid of him. Please. Please.
Right.
He's, yeah. So, yeah. It's not looking good. At the same time, though, Canadians are not as steeped in that as Americans are, generally speaking. We have a lot of pushback, like pushback against the anti-LGBTQ plus restrictions, even against the mass protests. Like there's a lot of protests and then there's huge showings for counter protests against the anti-trans people and things like that. So we're seeing school districts pushing back hard against restrictions, forcing, you know, any restrictions that are forcing kids to basically be outed to their parents if they come out to a teacher, things like that. These school districts are pushing back like, no, we're not going to do that. We're not doing that. We're not putting that. So, and then of course the politicians are like, well, we're going to take them to court over that and the pushback and all that sort of thing. But Canadians are not, on the whole, most Canadians are not here for that. So,
right. Yeah. Except the ones next to Idaho.
Yep. I mean, it's Idaho. That's right. Basically, yep.
I know. Idaho is a whole nother animal. They're even an outlier here in the United States. They're probably the most radical group of people outside of Missouri. And that's, it's like, okay, well, we're really glad they're a small state because man, them people are woo.
Yep. I think we both know somebody from Idaho who's been writing about the political situation there.
Well, yeah, and there's that. But I mean, I you know, again, I watch the news from everywhere, and it was about a year or so ago, there was a journalist that ventured up there and wrote an article for, I'm trying to remember who he was, because I said something about it last year, but he actually infiltrated basically up there. He just drove around, asked people questions without identifying himself as to who he was. And he came away with just like, oh my God, I didn't realize how bad this was. Oh my God, I need to get out of here right now before they find me. As one of those kind of deals. And he wrote an op-ed on his trip. And it was, you know, that's what kind of got my attention. And I think it was, I think it was either The Guardian or, I'm trying to think what's the other one I was reading about. It's one of those.
Not the BBC.
No, wasn't that like that. It was an American. And I'll think about it in about 5 minutes. You know how that goes. Yep. Yeah. I'm a senior citizen. I'm allowed to do that. but, uh, But you know, it goes back to what we got going on. So I was kind of curious. So you're seeing the same things that I am and up there as far as it goes. Now, are you guys as a whole worried about a new 4 more years of Trump?
Terrified. Absolutely terrified. When Trump was in office, it was genuinely a point of like, people were scared about what he was going to do. He's seen as a very, very unpredictable person. Mm-hmm. Not someone that he's unreliable in terms of like all of our foreign policies and such in connection with the United States. You guys are our largest trading partner. And he instituted a trade war with us. And the regulations and the tariffs and everything kind of screwed over our economy in a really bad way. Like we import all of our food from the States, and there were rashes of foodborne illnesses popping up because the regulations were reduced. Like, got to the point where I know people here who don't buy American produce. We check the label to make sure that it's, and that, yeah, so that.
I don't buy American produce.
See, that's the thing. But that kind of limits our options in that sense. So everything during the pandemic with our supply lines and all of the regulatory dips that he did, and then attacking our trade, it really screwed us economically and left a lot of people struggling. On top of that, we pay very close attention to American politics. And the idea of another Trump presidency where he doesn't have to worry about re-election for whatever reason is unnerving. I was in college the last time he was in office, and there was a moment where basically in my class, there were six of us, all six women, and we were sitting there just talking about Trump and talking about what he was doing and talking about how he was behaving on the world stage in front of everybody and the instability that we could see. And then our instructor came in and sat down, and we told her what we were talking about, and she just bluntly announced, "He scares me." And we all sat there for a minute, and kind of nobody looked at each other. We just kind of looked at the floor because we genuinely don't know what he's capable of doing. He's a self-aggrandizing narcissist.
Well, there's that. I mean, there's obviously he's got mental issues. But the thing is, I've been telling people this for years, you know, Donald Trump showed his true colors back in the 70s, and he never changed. The only reason he got elected in 2016 was because he basically catered. He said what people wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Okay. That was the bottom line. And back in those days, and you know, it's even worse now, but a large part of the American population, what I call the disenfranchised half, who were struggling from paycheck to paycheck, he promised them this and promised them that, and they laughed it up, hook, line, and sinker. And the fact that he could do it in such a manner, as far as the way his voice carried and so on and so forth, there's a reason why they're calling him the second Adolf Hitler, because he's good at saying the right things in the right way to the right people.
Exactly. And he's basically following exactly the same playbook that Hitler chose. Like, the economic system in the United States is deeply tied to every other country. Like, the economy of the global trade is based off of the United States dollar. The whole reason the Nazis were able to take power was because of the Great Depression. Yep. Like, the economic instability in the States completely destroyed the economy in Germany. The German mark went down to the point where, like, people's life savings couldn't even buy a loaf of bread. Right. And it was that economic uncertainty that Hitler spoke to in order to fan the anti-foreigner flame, to fan the German nationalist flame. And that's exactly what Trump is doing now.
Yep. Yeah. And that's the scary part about it is you're right. And what's the worst part is, and this is something I said in my op-ed last Sunday, is these people don't know that they're being conned.
Nope.
They don't know it. And you can't convince them otherwise.
No. And
these are the same people that go to these, what I call these evangelical Christian churches and stand up on the aisles and wave their hands and yell and scream and sing and all that stuff without really understanding what they're doing. And when they pass the hat, so to speak, they're all about throwing everything they can in the plate. And all this guy is doing is taking their money and running. And you know, Donald Trump is using the same playbook. He knows the grift, and he knows what he's doing. And it's obvious for anybody who's ever seen that in action before. But again, it goes back to these people are so unhappy with the way things have been going the last 20, 30 years that they'll vote for anybody that they think will get them out of the mess.
Yep.
You know, I'm thinking, okay, well, Donald Trump didn't do anything for you in his first 4 years. What makes you think he's going to do anything now? But you can't.
And even worse than that, he holds you in contempt.
Well, yeah.
Like, the man is classism personified. Mm-hmm. And that's what I grew up in, a town of less than 7,000 people. I grew up in the most rural area of my province, right? Like, there was nobody for miles kind of place. And the area around where I lived was so low value that people didn't even bother trying to sell their homes when they moved away. There are houses that are literally just abandoned because nobody's going to buy it, right? So that's where I grew up. So I understand how these people feel about feeling like they're trapped in poverty, feeling abandoned by the government, because in a lot of ways, yeah, they are. They absolutely are. And it doesn't do anybody any favors to pretend that that's not the case. And then the Democrats kind of pretend that they don't need to appeal to them because they're always going to vote Republican. So we don't need to talk to those people. Right. And it's like, well, why do you think that's the case? Right. Like, why do you think they're always going to vote Republican? And then Trump comes along and pulls the whole, I alone can fix it. I'm going to change everything. And then at one of his rallies goes, I love the poorly educated. Because he has no filter and he doesn't understand that he's supposed to keep his mouth shut. But they don't catch that, right? They don't catch that.
No. Well, the problem is they're not hearing the words. No, they're hearing his voice.
Yeah.
It's not what he says. It's how he says it.
It's the confidence.
That's the big thing about it. And unfortunately, you listen to one of his rallies, it's obvious from the get-go that he's basically shoving out a bunch of gibberish and they're buying it hook, line, and sinker. So I don't know. Yeah, and that's what worries me, is it doesn't look like Donald Trump is going to get brought down in any way between now and November. I mean, I think he's managed to bypass all that stuff at this point. So now there's not really any way for him to lose his credibility. You know, I say that only because how many of these American preachers lost everything when they got found out about their affairs or stealing money from the parishes and so on and so forth? They got found out, they got fired, and they lost everything. Well, Donald Trump doesn't have to worry about that. He's got that all locked up right now with his Supreme Court in his back pocket and everything else. So he's pretty much getting a free ride between now and November. So,
but, yeah, I will say that there's a little bit of that's starting to change, just a little bit. We saw after the RNC, they actually did a panel of independent voters, who watched his speech. And the consensus among all of them was, like, the first 30 minutes when he was reading off the teleprompter, fine. And then the second the teleprompter went down and he started talking, just Trump, they were like, no, I don't want anything to do with him. Because he started immediately with the insults and everything else. So he starts on the teleprompter, he's talking about unity. And then as soon as the teleprompter goes away, he starts insulting, he starts threatening, he starts acting his usual self. Yeah. And they were like, we can tell right away that his message is fake.
Yep.
That clued a lot of people in. And then on the other side now, we've got Kamala, who just did her first appearance as the candidate for the Democratic side. Not yet the nominee, but the candidate. And she hammered him hard. She went after him. And in the way that I've been waiting for Biden to do, in the way that I have really wanted him to do, because she was a prosecutor, right? And she is using that narrative as prosecutor versus convicted felon. And that's what she's going with. So she's hammering how she went up against people for sexual assault. And she held that he was held liable for sexual assault in court. She said that she took down basically college scams, right? He used to run one of those. So she's hammering all of these over and over and over again. And it's like, yes, that's what people need to be reminded of, because that's what's going to remind them this guy doesn't mean anything that he says. He doesn't pay the people who work for him. He tries to get out of it as much as he can. He's never successfully run a business in his life. Like, yeah. He's hammering all these points to try and take down the persona that he's built up around himself, which mm-hmm. is very important because, like you said, that's what's got people.
Right.
It's like my father visited not that long ago when we were talking about American politics. And he said that he had asked one of his buddies, because he couldn't get it. He's mm-hmm. like, what do people see in Donald Trump? So he's like, because to him, he's like, this guy's just a maniac.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what do people see in him? And his buddy looks at him and goes, well, Kyle, they see themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad goes, you know what? I think you're right. And that's horrifying. And it's like, yeah, that's what it is. They see themselves when they look at him and they hear their voices when he talks. Mm-hmm. And that's what you have to dismantle if you're going to take him down. And it's good to see that they're starting to go for that. Yeah.
Well, the big thing is, like, it goes back to what you were saying. When Joe Biden was the front, presumptive candidate, the independents were like, oh, no, we're not voting for this guy. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's the biggest thing that scares the MAGA cult. And I don't even call them Republicans anymore. They're not Republicans. They're the MAGA party. Okay. And the thing is, that's what they were trying to do really hard, was to get all of these independent voters here in the United States to swing in their direction. And they almost had them. Now everything's changed. And because Kamala's getting a head start, she's, like I said earlier, she's going to Wisconsin. I'm going to bet that she's going to swing through Michigan here pretty quickly. And
probably,
she's
going
to swing through all of those areas up there. They're always kind of on the fence with either a Democrat or Republican ahead of the election. But she's going to do everything that Hillary Clinton didn't do in 2016. And she's going to probably win over a large majority of these independent voters. And that's exactly what it's going to take to get rid of this MAGA cult.
Absolutely. And even more than that, it's actually brilliant. Like, Kamala replacing Biden on the ticket is brilliant in many different ways. But the two biggest ones are, one, she's 59 years old.
Hmm.
She is now, they can't use the age rhetoric anymore because Trump is 78. Trump is now the old man on the ticket who's doing gaffes in public. So the Republicans can't use that anymore, which means their entire strategy for going after Biden now has to be thrown out. They can't use it. Hmm. The other thing, a lot of people that were choosing not to vote for Biden this time around was because of what's going on in Israel-Palestine conflict, right? Because of the genocide that's going on in Gaza. They lost interest in supporting Biden because he was actively supporting Israel. Kamala, back in March, called for a ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
She called for a ceasefire against Israel to help the Palestinian people. If she hammers that, that's two of their major talking points completely removed. On the other side, you could tell immediately that the energy changed as soon mm-hmm. as she took up, because I believe it was, I think the New York Times reported, within 24 hours of her announcing her candidacy, she raised $81 million off of donations. And I think in Nevada, there were 600 volunteers who signed up the first day. So the energy has completely changed. She mm-hmm. has reinvigorated the party. She has reinvigorated basically everybody. So those two issues are gone. And on the other side, the fact that she is currently Biden's VP means that she has a great campaign structure to go for, because he's now a lame duck president. He doesn't have to worry about re-election anymore. So all those things he's been trying to push for, student loan debt, medical debt was one thing that she raised, I believe, and things like that. Like, they can now push for those things. And mm-hmm. she, acting as his vice president, can take credit and use that on the campaign trail. So she has a fantastic platform to work for. If she sticks the landing and continues along that line, she can pull in everybody, right?
Yeah. Well, let's see what happens. I'm all about seeing what happens.
Yeah. Now, then again, we are talking about the Democrats, who are good at, snatching defeat from the jaws of certain victories. So we'll see. But
I'm waiting for them to shoot themselves in the foot here. See, that's the problem.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, and kind of with what's going on with J.D. Vance. I don't really want to talk about him, truthfully. He's an idiot.
Yes, he is.
But this whole business, because one of your biggest advocacies has been LGBTQ stuff, trans stuff, and everything else, not just in Canada, but the United States. You did a piece on Central Africa, Uganda, not too long ago. So let's talk about that a little bit. Do you see any uptick in, and you mentioned it a little bit with, you know, this premier in New Brunswick, but there's, you know, out west, western provinces have been kind of shading in that direction as well. But I mean, have you seen it getting any worse?
Yes, actually, the past few years, I have seen it getting worse here. And it is directly following the United States, like I said. Like, we're seeing the same exact rhetoric, the same... we're seeing the word woke pop up a lot. Canadian politicians have kind of been testing the waters on social media, using those terminology and then sharing those memes to see how the Canadian public responds, right? And then they start to push in the restrictions and bring in the talking points and the whole, well, we don't know that we should be talking to children about these things and that sort of thing. Like, that's just them seeing how the public responds. We've also been seeing, there have been a couple of people who are known as like these big preachers and anti-LGBTQ plus organizers and things like that have been hosting mass protests. There was one in Ontario during Pride, things like that. So that's been popping up a lot more. Just recently in the city that I live near, the Pride events had to be canceled because threats of violence were shared. Wow. So things like that, it is amping up here. It's not to the same degree as in the States. We're not quite there yet, but it's very much, we can see it coming ahead of us down the pipeline. And so that means we've got time, because like I say, a lot of Canadians are not, they're not good with that. They're, a lot of us are queer, or we know queer people, we know LGBTQ plus people, we have loved ones who are LGBTQ plus, and we're not interested in seeing their rights and our own rights tramped upon. So yeah, there's it's amping up, but there's also a lot more pushback here than we're seeing in the States.
So this kind of falls back a little bit on stuff north of the border there. Is Trudeau starting to feel the heat a little bit?
I think so. However, Trudeau at least has always been an open LGBTQ plus advocate. He's always been staunchly in favor of LGBTQ plus rights. He attends Pride. He's very vocal about that. And he has basically outright stated, like, look, we're not doing that. The federal government is not doing that while I'm in charge. He's actually openly criticized he's openly criticized Alberta for their restrictions. He's gone after the premier of New Brunswick several times for several different issues, including anti-abortion issues, because that premier is one of those, not quite a Christian nationalist, but about as close as you get here, which that's considered very uncouth in Canadian politics. You don't generally push your religion in Canadian politics. So that is like the main point of like, we don't like that. So Trudeau has come down hard on him and on Alberta and on Saskatchewan. So he's
telling me he's fired and send him south to the border. He'll fit right in.
leave North Florida and go to actual Florida. Yeah. You get along great with Ron DeSantis, but yeah. So yeah, Trudeau, I would say nobody's perfect. He's not the perfect candidate. I'm looking forward to him potentially being replaced by somebody who maybe will not support the pipelines, who will have a better track record, who will not be criticized so heavily for corruption and things like that. There's also the blackface issue and all those things from the past. So there's issues with Trudeau for sure. But yeah, he definitely does advocate more for human rights than some of the other premiers that we're dealing with right now.
So just out of curiosity, what do you think the conservatives up there have a strong push to take over from him?
Unfortunately, Poilievre is considered a little bit more popular right now, which
that's
is
what I've been hearing.
Yeah. I don't think he will win, but it's also not a sure thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're
the United States. We don't think Trump's going to win, but it's not a sure thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, he's hammering down on, he's attacking Trudeau personally. Right. So yeah, Trudeau is not popular. So he's hammering on that. And it's one of those things where it's like on the political issues, he's much more in line with the United States than he is in Canada. But there is that concern, right? So it is possible that we may wind up seeing the Tories take control again. Ooh. We really don't want that, but yeah, that's always possible.
Well, I'll be watching. I'll be rooting for you guys.
We need it. Thank you.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's kind of a hard which way to go. I mean, I hate to see you guys fall in line with the Americans, truthfully. America's in a bad shape, and it's not going to get any better. I don't really care who gets the next 4 years, whether it's Harris. Obviously, you know, and this is something I've been saying all along. If the MAGA party takes over, we're done. Okay.
Yeah.
The United States is finished. That's a given.
Yeah.
And the other part of that is, like you said, whatever happens here in the lower 48 is going to affect you guys. So, you know, if the MAGA party takes over, then you guys are going to have you're probably going to get your butts whipped in a lot, economically, in a lot of other ways.
Yeah,
you
know, that's going to cause serious issues. Yeah.
Wow, that's not a good thing.
Nope.
I mean, the Mexicans right now are kind of shading the bet. I mean, they're part of this whole North American free trade agreement as well. But I've noticed that they started cozying up really, really well with China here lately. They a lot of new factories coming in. They're moving on. They're pretty much done with this. They're all about taking what they can from the States, but they're not dependent on us anymore.
No.
And I think that's a good thing for them. I'm be interested to see how far they're going to go with it. But meanwhile, though, you guys are kind of all on your own. It's not like you can reach across the ocean and shake hands with the Labour government over there in the UK. I mean, Starmer's struggling right now, trying to put things together. He doesn't have time for anybody else.
That would be a hard sell with Canada anyway.
It would be, yeah. You know, the Australians are having the same problem. They got their own set of issues going down there. And so it's kind of like, well, okay, Commonwealth, yeah, not so much anymore. Everybody's kind of on their own. So, you know, Canada, unfortunately, is almost isolated in its own way. And again, whatever happens here, unfortunately, it's going to happen to you guys. And I hate to see that. I really do. So
we're hoping for a better outcome.
Right.
And we're fighting
for
a better outcome.
So just out of curiosity, and I kind of pose this kind of question to you only because, you know, having transferred myself back and forth across the border numerous times, and I saw how ugly the Americans are firsthand. Do you ever see where things are getting so bad here that the Canadian customs would close the border? I mean, well, restrict it severely?
Restrictions, yes. But I don't see them ever closing it. And there are several good reasons for that. One, because you are our largest trading partner. A lot of our produce is shipped overland from the United States, so we can't afford to not have that line open because we don't have many other options, right? The other thing is the connection between Canada and the United States is so strong that the majority of us have family and friends on either side of the border. Mm. Like, almost all of us have family that crisscross the border. I do. Like, my in-laws, my partner's entire family is over there. Right. I travel back and forth for that reason, to see them. So it's one of those things where it's like, nobody would be in favor of completely closing the border. That would not go over well with anybody.
It would strangle you guys severely.
Yeah. So we would never see a complete closure. Tightening up and heavier restrictions, absolutely. Absolutely, I could see that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably not a bad thing, truthfully, as crazy as Americans are these days. I mean, if the Democrats do win, which I hope they do, I can see things going back to kind of somewhat normal for both of us, far as it goes. But, I mean, I'm scared to death if these other people, they take over. I mean, all hell's going to break loose everywhere, not just in North America, but everywhere else as well. And that worries me more than anything else. This whole business of Trump saying, I can end Ukraine war in one day. I'm like, and Putin is over there saying, oh, no, nah, I'm sorry.
If Trump goes back into office, we're going to see a lot more global unrest is the thing, because he's already talked about pulling out of NATO. He's already talked about pulling out of the Paris Accord again. And all of these, like, he's already raging against all the international alliances that the United States has. He's very America first. Which is great for the nationalists in America, but for those of us who live in reality.
that's the problem. Yeah. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work out, truthfully. Far as that goes. So how are the wildfires? I know you got a bunch of them out west again.
Oh yes. Every single year they're getting worse and worse, unfortunately. Right. Thankfully this year we haven't had any where I live yet. Last year it was a little bit dicey where we were actually surrounded. Thankfully the wind took it down towards the coast and we were spared. Over the past few years out in BC, especially, the wildfire season has gotten so bad that several towns have been wiped off the map and people have been forced to become climate refugees, essentially. Mm-hmm. So this year it started early. The heavy rains have kind of tamped it down a little bit, but we still have months to go before the wildfire season ends. So,
right. Well, I mean, even last year with the fires so bad up in the boreal forest, the fires actually never really went out. They just kind of went underground.
Yep. No, we've got several fires that are still ongoing that started last year. Yeah.
Ooh. Ooh. Yeah. So here's another thing. Economically speaking, I mean, I know Canada as a whole has always, ever since I can remember, depended heavily on their wood products industry. I mean, this has got to be affecting that hugely.
Absolutely. Our lumber is, like you say, it's a huge industry here in Canada, and that's from coast to coast. All the way over in BC, especially with the old growth forest there, although a lot of us are protesting that because they really should not be cut down, carbon sequestration being what it is. But yeah, having massive swaths of the forest burned down does make the lumber industry kind of suffer a little bit. We have other industries as well. Mining is a huge issue here. Like the Ring of Fire in Ontario was just opened up for mining again. So all of our industries are very bad for the environment, as it turns out. But yeah, like our paper mills and pulp mills, they do definitely struggle when the wildfire season comes through.
Yeah. Because I remember it's always been a big thing. But yeah, the mining industry too. Again, you know, like you're talking about, there's no real winning this. I mean, you got to have this stuff out of the ground in order to survive as far as countries is concerned. If you look at the national view, every country in the world digs its ground up looking for minerals to sell. Everybody does it. It's the only way we can survive. But I don't think anybody has really come up with a good climate friendly way to do this. I mean, truthfully, I mean, digging huge gouts of ground out to get at something is never good for the environment. I don't care what, but still, it's one of those deals. You know, you have to have it, but you cringe every time one of those big, you know, backhoes digs a hole on the ground. It's like,
There's a lot of issues with mining for the environment. Like I wrote a piece not that long ago, I think a couple months ago, where I dug into the problems of illegal mining in the Amazon. And a lot of those problems actually carry on here too, because the mining industry is extremely dirty. Yeah. And I mean that in terms of toxic chemicals. Yep. I'm a jeweler. I work with some toxic chemicals as well as what I do. We're talking about like just the act of refining metal that you pull out of the soil. You have to go through several forms of acid. You're extracting heavy metals and that winds up going into the ecosystem, right? So we wind up poisoning water supplies. We wind up destroying swaths of forest again, because we're making the water unusable for the plants as well. So the entire system is breaking down. Yeah. So there's nothing that we do. There's no industry at all that is good for the environment. No mass industry that's good for the environment, unfortunately.
Now, unfortunately, unless we want to revert back to being hunter-gatherers again.
Yeah. Which is unsustainable with our size of civilization, unfortunately.
No. Now, with 8 billion people on a planet, that ain't going to work.
No.
Of course, there's some thoughts that we're going to have a pandemic. It's going to wipe out a good portion of the population. I'm like, well, I wouldn't actually make that a positive thing.
No, that's not a good thing.
No, it's not a good thing.
No, mass death is never a good thing.
No, I mean, I have been to countries around the world, several third world countries, and I've seen how the conditions these people live in. And it's one thing when you go to a country and they've never known anything better. So you can't give them something and to make their life a little bit better, but truthfully half the time they don't know what to do with it. Okay. So you find out when you ask them, they're very content with the way, with their way of life. They don't really want change. So, okay, you know what? What can we do to make your life a little bit better today? What can I do for you today? I don't care about long-term. What can we do for you today? Well, you know, one of the things I found out 20-some years ago, my last trip to the Middle East, when I asked these questions, all they care about was the basics. Give us clean water. Help us deal with our trash. Okay. Help, you know, fix our sewage systems. Give us clean water. Give us electricity. We can manage with the rest. We can take care of everything else. Give us those three things and we're happy with anything else.
Yep. And give them the, like, help them build the systems that allow them to be sustainable in the long term.
Yep.
That's, yep.
That's it, you know? But unfortunately, Americans never got that memo. And when I kicked that memo back upstairs, I got pushback saying, no, you're not a team player, Sergeant.
No. We need to send people over there to build houses on the ground, and we need to give them shoes and things like that. And yeah,
well,
it's fascinating to me. I've written a piece about that as well, where like we have this notion of charity in other countries being vastly different from how we think of it here. Right. Because when we think of small towns here in North America, we think in those terms. We think about improving infrastructure. We think about building the long-term stability. Yeah. And then when we think about Africa, we think, oh, we'll do food drops. But people have the exact same problems there as they do here. So why do we think of it so differently, right? We do one-time drop and then we walk away and we never, but that doesn't help anybody. That doesn't actually, that we're not actually achieving anything. We're just basically just giving them a pat on the head and walking away. And like, that's not helpful. It just makes you feel good. It's insulting. Yeah. Frankly.
Well, it is. I mean, that was part of my thing, which got me so angry all those years ago, was that I actually talked to the people that I work with. And I asked them, I said, what is it that you want? You know, we're running around here doing all, you know, I'm getting orders from my top saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. I said, well, what exactly do you want? Okay. Do you want what they're trying to give you? No, we ain't got no use for that. Oh, we just want the three basics: electricity, water, and clean up the mess. And in this case, this particular stretch where I was working at, all they cared about was rebuilding what the Russians destroyed. You know, plumbing, electricity, stuff like that. They had it before the Russians came. Russians destroyed it, and the Americans came in saying, "Oh, we're going to help you. We're going to rebuild your country." Well. Okay.
How? How are you going to rebuild it?
The American idea of rebuilding the country was building schools and put money into medical clinics and stuff like that, which, you know, the schools up to a point were okay, depends, but they, you know, the Americans as usual built their model on American models and not Islamic models. So they failed to take the Islamic model into consideration. Mm-hmm. So they just went willy-nilly, built all this stuff up, and everybody is standing around like, well, why are you doing that? You know, as soon as you leave, it's going to be gone.
Yep.
You know,
yeah, I'm not an expert in what was going on in the Middle East during the wars, but I did hear a lot of that, where it was very much the Americans come in. It's like, we're going to introduce the American system to this. And meanwhile, they're like, well, that's not how we've lived for the past ever.
Right.
So none of our systems are going to work that way. None of our culture is going to work that way. Nobody's ever lived that way here. So that's going to completely destroy everything.
Yeah, and it pretty much did. Yeah, it pretty much did. And like I said, when I voiced the opinions of the people I was talking to on the ground, I got told, no, you know, you're not playing, you're not, you're not echoing the ROE. And I'm like, oh, what? Mm-hmm. Okay. So I gave up after that. It's like, all right, whatever. You know,
you do.
That's
a whole
other thing. Yeah. Well, you know, but the thing is that kind of what I was already an activist before that, but you know, being in the military, I kept my mouth shut. Well, mostly, mostly. I had to get in a little bit of trouble back in 1983, but that's another story. But the big thing is, after I came away from my trip to Afghanistan, back in 2002, my mind was completely different. My activism took on a new level. And as soon as I got off active duty, I was all over the place with what I could do. As it goes, even moving to Northern Maine, I advocated for things, what little bit you can do with what little bit of media you can get a hold of up there. Mm-hmm. But up there, you can pretty much do whatever you want. Nobody can say anything because there's not enough people to say anything. you know how. I mean, you're familiar with New Brunswick. No, Aroostook yep. County, Maine is no different than Western New Brunswick.
Okay? No, nope. I've traveled through Maine several times. Small there town you go. Maine is interesting places in Maine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a polite word to say what Maine.
That's where I ran into one of those guys who thinks the government controls the weather while his wife was trying to convince everybody to go to church with her. Hmm. That was a fun conversation. But yeah.
I'll bet. Yeah. Yeah, I ran into some. One of the things I ran into up there, and I didn't realize, I knew a little bit about when I was a kid growing up there. I mean, I grew up on a very poor farm there up in Aroostook County, but I didn't realize, until I was an adult and I moved back, just some of the people. So there's so many people living up there, not just that county, but other remote counties in the state where people from the lower 40. The other 40 some odd states were on the run, and they picked mm-hmm. Northern Maine as a place to run to. I'm like, okay.
I mean, it's remote. I'll give it that. Yeah. It's definitely remote. Yeah.
I ran into quite a few people up there when I was living up there. They were on the run from somewhere. Mm-hmm. They weren't from Maine, and they came from really far away. I know a guy, a former army guy. He ran all the way from South Florida, all the way to the Canadian border. And when he hit the border, he realized, okay, I can't run any farther. The Canadians aren't going to let me in, so I need to hide somewhere. So that's exactly what he did.
Yeah.
I met another guy. He was on a run from something, and he bought a patch of land, a piece of farmland that somebody was selling. Out in the middle of nowhere, and he set up a yurt, and he lived in his. He may still be up there for all I know, but he was living. Even when I left in 2015, he was still living in this Mongol yurt out in the middle of this cow pasture. No electricity, no plumbing, no nothing. And I'm like, and the government's let him do this? And when I asked somebody about it, they said, "Oh no, it's his property. He can do whatever he wants." I'm like, really?
Okay. Yep. That's basically how it is. And yeah, it was funny. The last time I went through Maine, just a few months ago, last time I was there, there was a retired FBI agent hanging out at the bar. And he was known to the locals. Like, they all knew who he was, and they kind of pointed him out to me and all that sort of thing, because I stay at the same place every time. So kind of everybody was chatting with him, because it's a tiny little tap room, and you say something on one end, everybody hears it, right? And he was just telling stories and telling stories and telling stories. And so, yeah, I found out a lot. I found out a lot about what goes on in that small town, because he's hooked up with the law enforcement there and everything else. There's apparently a big drug problem there. Apparently a big drug smuggling problem there, because it's close to the border. Yeah. That doesn't surprise me, because we have the same problem here. But yeah, it was very much a, okay, so there's a lot more going on in these small towns than people tend to think.
Oh yeah.
Which shouldn't be a surprise for me, given where I grew up, and I know all the dirty laundry about up there, but every now and then you get caught. So,
it's funny about small town stuff. And, it goes back to what we said in the very beginning. You take that same attitude that you were just talking about, and whether it's in New Brunswick or whether it's in Maine, the attitudes are kind of, small town attitudes are basically the same thing. What's in it for us? And that's the majority. What I took at the rural, what I call the rural mentality, and it's not just Maine, but it's in every rural state across North America. Okay. Whether it's Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, or it's Idaho or Montana or Texas, the same rural mentality is the same. We've had the boot on our neck now for 40 years. We need somebody that's going to root for us. And what are you going to, you're going to be the next politician. What are you going to do for me? Okay. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do for me and the people in my small town? And that's, you know, that's what it's basically what politics is boiled down to. And as you say, you know, Canadian politics is kind of mirroring the United States on a smaller scale. So what the news that I'm seeing coming out of the Western provinces, Manitoba, not quite so much, but Saskatchewan and Alberta mirrors a lot of what I see in these so-called red states here in the United States. The same stuff that's coming across the news wires. And it all boils down to we're rural. The government has forgotten about us. We don't like what's going on over there. They don't understand us. We need to fix this. Who's going to fix it for us? And lo and behold, you get somebody like Paul Vieira or Trump saying, hey, I can fix this for you.
And the big thing is they show up. The big thing is they go to those towns and they campaign there, right? They actually face them face to face, which is a big thing in rural communities as well, is that being able to look somebody in the eye. That's right. A huge thing, right? And that's, again, like what you were saying with Kamala Harris, where she was going through Wisconsin and things like that. That's what Hillary Clinton didn't do. Exactly. So she really hammered home the, I'm the elitist, that whole like stereotype of the Democrats being the coastal elites who don't pay attention to the rural towns. And then Trump goes through coal country and talks to them about bringing their jobs back, because someone told them that's what they care about. And it is. They care about jobs. They care about their tradition. They care about the opioid epidemic is huge in rural communities. It's massive. Here it's meth. In the States, it's opiates, right? Mm-hmm. So the drug problem, things like anyone who's going to hammer on those issues is going to get their vote immediately.
That's right. I'll give you an example. And this is one I remember. 2015, Trump was running for election. So he gave a speech at the Carrier factory up in Northern Ohio, I think it was.
Yeah.
And told everybody everywhere, hey, I'm going to do something. I'm going to make sure this company doesn't go to Mexico, and I'm going to fine them if they go, and so on and so forth. Everybody's cheering, clapping. Hey, okay. He's standing up for the little guy. Well, guess what? What did Carrier do? They went to Mexico.
He didn't do anything. That's the thing. Like, he can say what he wants, but he doesn't do anything to help anybody. Right. If you actually talk to these people, nothing changed. Nothing measurably got better in any of those small towns.
But he got their vote, though.
Didn't stay, but he got their vote. Yep. And the sad thing is, if he goes through and makes the same promises, he'll probably get their vote again. So,
same thing, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, how about, tell us about what your plans are for your website here. I know you posted, so tell us right here.
So, for the past while, World Weary was kind of an experiment. When I started out, like, it was kind of just a hosting place. I started out on Substack as a host for my newsletter. I didn't really think I'd get a lot of attention. I was just a random Canadian screaming onto the internet. I'd gotten some success on Medium kind of thing, but I wanted to diversify a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then the whole issue started with Substack and the Nazis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Yeah. So I was one of the people that got targeted. I was one of the people where they actually started harassing me. I was one of the people that was having them show up, tell me I'm going to hell, telling me, you know, calling me very unfortunate slurs used by Nazis for certain segments of the population, things like that. And it's like, so I could block them off of my newsletter, but I couldn't block them anywhere else. And so I got heavily involved with the push to try and get Substack to bring in some content moderation, because, yeah, it's great that we can block people and not have to see what they're writing. That doesn't help me if one of them gets a hold of my address and posts it for their followers.
Right.
And you guys aren't going to take that down. You're not going to do anything about it. So that's going to be out there. So for all I know, someone's going to show up at my door with a gun because they don't like what I have to say. Right. And so that's something that I pushed hard against, and we pushed hard against it, and we pushed hard against it. And a lot of us started getting messages from our followers saying, hey, is there a way that I can pay you for the newsletter without giving money to Substack, because 10% of your earnings through it goes to the company? So we started seeing things like that, and I started looking into somewhere where I could make the jump, where I would have better control over things. So I jumped to Ghost, which allowed me to expand more heavily as well, because that gives me a full website that I can build off of now. So I have the newsletter, which goes out every week, and then I have Unfiltered, the podcast that I put out twice every 2 weeks for my paying subscribers. And then, yeah, I have a lot more freedom to build off of it. So for the past while, I've been kind of reworking what kind of content I'm going to be putting out. I've already started with like choosing a monthly topic and hammering on it and keeping all my episodes on that topic so I can provide a deep dive instead of just talking about current events and what's going on in the world and just kind of picking things willy-nilly to put out as it appeals, which I think is going a lot better. It allows me to plan things out ahead of time and to actually like delve into the topics with a little more clarity. The other thing I want to do is introduce extra pages on the website, which will basically be hub pages for general information on various causes that I talk about. Human rights, climate change, politics, things like that, democracy. And just giving a general overview of them, the history of those conflicts, information like links to articles that I've written on the subject for deeper reading, and lists of charities and organizations that you can actually like reach out to and volunteer with or donate to. I want to turn the website into like a hub for information for people who want to get involved in activism but don't know how.
Okay.
So that's something that I'm working on right now. I'm building them behind the scenes before I publish them all. So it's going to be a while before they go out, but that is something that I'm working on right now. I'm also working on an ebook, which is very frustrating to write because it's something that keeps changing over time. Have you ever run into that thing where you try to explain a dog whistle to someone, what a dog whistle is in politics, and try to sound like try to get them to understand what it is without coming across like a crazy person? So I run into that all the time where I have to point out, it's like, 1488 in that person's username. That person's a Nazi. And then people look at me like I'm insane. And I have to explain, okay, so the 14 goes back to the 14 words and the characteristics of fascism. And then the 88 stands for HH, which is Hail Hitler, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the sign off that a lot of Nazis used. So now these two numbers together mean Nazi. So having to explain that whole thing without sounding like a conspiracy theorist takes up a lot of my time. When I mentioned it in my writing, right? So it got to the point where I got real tired of having to have that conversation over and over and over again. So I decided to come up with basically a little primer. So I'm working on the World Weary Guide to Dog Whistles. And that'll be a downloadable ebook on the website that is going to basically explain what a dog whistle is, the history of the term, how they're used, various lists of dog whistles used by various subgroups like the trans exclusionary radical feminists or Christian nationalists, the Nazis, and things like that. So it shows, basically just breaks it down and teaches you what those dog whistles are and how to spot them and what they mean, right? So I'm working on that. It's in the revision stage.
Yeah.
Hopefully that'll go
out. I can actually see how that might be popular.
I'm hoping so. At the very least, it'll be less of a headache for me.
I could see people actually wanting to buy something like that.
Yeah.
Simply because there's a lot of trash going on these days.
Yeah.
And
it would be good for people to just understand how these things work, because we do hear a lot of dog whistles going on. And that's a big. That's a big thing that we see it often. We only really see it on the right wing these days. And that's another question that I've had people ask is like, well, you always talk about right wing dog whistles, but what about the left wing? And well, the left doesn't really need to use dog whistles anymore because dog whistles exist to obfuscate what you mean to say. But the issues of human rights and things like that are very mainstream. They're within the Overton window right now. So we don't need them.
Right.
Except for like when Roe v. Wade was just overturned, we got things like people saying, if you need a camping trip across the border, I'll help you get to your campground and you can stay with me while you need the camp. You know, like, so like things like that pop up when it needs to be obfuscated. Whereas on the right wing, a lot of their issues are becoming more mainstream now. And we're seeing that death of a euphemism, like when Trump came out and was like, hey, I'm not going to talk about protecting jobs. I'm just going to talk about not letting immigrants in. So that dog whistle kind of died, but that was the dog whistle before. So that, I think it's something that constantly evolves, but once you learn to recognize them, you're better equipped to recognize new ones as they come out. Right. So it's a useful analytical tool that I'd like to share with people.
There's nothing wrong with that at all. Well, I'll be on the lookout for that. I'll see how that works out. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go here. So I appreciate you coming on the show. And I'm hoping that what we talked about today will resonate with a lot of people. It's good to see your side of the side of things, because believe it or not, most Americans, unless they live in one of the border areas, have no idea what's going on north of the border, truthfully. Yeah. Most Americans I find live with their heads in the sand, and they don't bring their heads out unless something hits them in the butt. And as long as everything is safe, their tail feathers are not being pulled out, they're okay with that. And, you know, growing up on the border, like I said, I got both sides of the equation. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, there were just as many commuters going back and forth across the Madawaska Bridge. So in the morning commute, you'd have Canadians coming south into the United States to work and Americans going north across the bridge to go to work in New Brunswick. And yep. It was vice versa at nighttime. And then, like I said, after 9/11, everything changed. One of my first clues, I wasn't living at home, was right after that. My late mother told me that right after 9/11, one of the first things they did was obviously shut off the border. So, like, there's a couple of towns up there on the border. One of them was Fort Fairfield, Maine. And maybe 20% of the town is in New Brunswick. Okay. Mm-hmm. So all the golfers in Fort Fairfield got mad because when 9/11 come along, Customs and Border Patrol, Homeland Security, basically shut off the back half of the golf course.
Yeah. So, I remember reading about that particular town.
Yeah.
People were very upset during the pandemic.
Yeah. The Americans could only play the first nine. You know? Mm-hmm. And then there was another, my mom told me about another town up on the other side. It was a little town called St. Francis on the other side of Fort Kent. And a lot of the people up there, it's a very, very, very small town. And a lot of the people in this town, the church was over in New Brunswick. Mm-hmm. But they were just crossing and going. And they've never. And then all of a sudden, Homeland Security shut off the road, said, nope. This is, you know, you're crossing into Canada. You can't go there anymore. So now they had to go all the way to Fort Kent, cross the bridge, and then go across the highway in New Brunswick to go to church. And obviously, you know, they raised a big stink about that. Not that it went anywhere.
Similar things happened during the pandemic where we had plenty of stories, news stories about families who were just basically living on the other side of town, but they can't see each other anymore. So there's these great pictures of like family members lined up on one side and then like 20 yards away, the rest of the family's over there. They're just yelling back and forth about, how was your day? You know, they go back, all the customs patrol are just standing there watching because they can't go up and see each other. So they're just standing there yelling across the way. But it's the absurdity of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know. Yeah. You have to wonder about some of these people. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, again, I appreciate you coming on. And I'm really hoping that now we've kind of opened the door a little bit between the Americans and the Canadians. Somewhat here so they can see how the other half lives and we'll see how far that goes. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be here, Terry.
All right. Thank you. Take care now. Stay warm up there.
Stay dry.
So as I said, I appreciate Sam for joining me here. This show is one of those where I like to open it up to whoever's got a lot of interesting things to talk about. And I want to kind of get everybody a broad view of things. As I said, you know, her perspective where she lives, it would be a lot different than if I was interviewing somebody from Saskatchewan, I'm sure. So take that with a grain of salt, but then it's no different than, you know, where I live here on the East Coast compared to somebody's viewpoint that was living in Idaho. So you can take that for what it's worth. So with that, I'll say goodbye, and I'll talk to you again next week. Sláinte. While I still have your attention, I want to tell you about how you can support this podcast and my efforts in general. This podcast will continue to remain free to subscribe to on all the major mobile podcast apps, on my YouTube channel, Crown of Biha, and for the first 30 days on my Substack page, Crown of Biha, the Tree of Life at Substack.com. With that in mind, I'm asking for donations of any amount. Decided that I would rather ask for donations instead of charging subscriptions so everyone has an opportunity to watch or listen to this podcast everywhere in the world. All I'm asking for is help in defraying the cost to produce and distribute this podcast and maintain my website. I've set up a donation tab on the Village Oak Tree webpage at rss.com and a donation page on my website at www.crownofbiha.com, which are all linked to PayPal for your security. This way you can use any currency you wish from around the world, providing PayPal is available to you. Any amount's appreciated. Now, about my website. The easiest way to find it is to copy it from the background behind me if you're watching this video. If you're listening to an audio version, copy the website name from the podcast logo shown. Search for it and enjoy your visit. Lastly, I'm trying to sell some copies of my book, Fugitives in the New United States, which can be found at major book retailers around the world, such as Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Lulu. You can also buy from me direct through the bookstore page on my website. Fugitives in the New United States is available in hardcover, paperback, and digital form. Free if you're a Kindle subscriber. It's written for young adults and older, so it's safe. If this were a movie, it'd be rated PG. Look for Fugitives in the New United States at your favorite book retailer and enjoy it. I sell enough, I'll find the time to write the second book in this series. So I want to thank you for your support, even if it's just a like and a subscribe on my social media accounts. Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed it and you'll return again for another episode of The Village Oak Tree. Please like, subscribe, and reply on the YouTube videos or the audio podcast where that's available. This helps with spreading the word about what I'm trying to do, like so many others, which is to shout about all the bad things our governments are doing to us all over the world. If enough of us decide that we don't want to take it anymore, we can force the governments to do right by us as we elected them to do. As I say goodbye this week, I wish to leave you with this Irish blessing as you go about your day. May your hand always be stretched out in friendship and never in want. Slán go fóill.